Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
Been a while, but we are back here on the Jewelcast. This is Eric. We are waiting for Nick to join. We haven't done this in a while, so bear with us. If you can't hear anything, if you anything sounds off, go ahead and do what you usually do, which is tweet frantically at us until we notice. Let's see if Nick's on the line. Nick, you there? Perfect. All right, bear with us for just a minute, and we'll see if we can we can do this. Good news, everyone. After only 15 minutes or so, it looks like we might be on. Let's see this.
Hello.
Hey, Nick, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Wow. Unbelievable. So, like we were saying the entire time, the podcast was set to start at 8:15. Should we play the opening again, or do we just go from here?
I think we should not play the opening again. That is my opinion on the opening, and we should move on.
I just want to hear Bob Miller, man. That's all.
I do miss Bob. I like Nick Nixon, though, so it's not all bad. John Rosen good on the radio. Not all bad for Kings fans, but come back soon, Bob.
Yeah, John's killing it. Okay, cool. So
okay.
Thanks for staying with us, everybody. We might edit those 15 minutes out, but if not, just stay with it.
You know, sometimes Kings seasons start slow, but they end well, and we're just going to go after that model here. Strong finish,
absolutely.
Slow start. Before we get into the meat of the show, there's been some changes at Jewels since the last time we aired, which was about a year ago. I guess most notably, we don't have John Carroll hosting anymore. We also have lost Marissa, who didn't contribute a lot in her time there on the site, but was a part of the site. Lemia was another one. And then, of course, Langley, also known as T. They don't contribute to the site anymore because hockey has not been a very welcoming place. Hockey and hockey media especially has not been a very welcoming place for them. They are all wonderful people, and I hope someday we get a chance to see them again, either on Jewels or more active in the hockey community, because that means that hockey and hockey media will have done a better job of including them in the conversation and making them feel welcome. So I hope they come back soon, and I hope we can all do better going forward in welcoming people like them.
Absolutely, and it's a strange place to start the JewelCast from, but I think it's appropriate because it's something that, you know, can't just be shoved under the rug. So with that, welcome to JewelCast, everybody. Again, thanks for staying with us and for tuning in. It's been it is March 23rd. The season started back in October, so we kind of do have a lot to talk about. And I think there's no real place to start from other than talking about how the Kings are officially qualified for the 2016 playoffs, meaning that we are at the polar opposite of where we were the last time we did this podcast, which was the day before the Kings lost to the Oilers in Game 80. So so things have turned around a little bit. Nick, I don't know. I think we should probably start by talking about some of the highs of this season, especially compared to last season.
Well, there have been highs this season, which is nice. I mean, last season was not fun at any point, really. A couple of win streaks that were pretty short, I guess, but not a lot of good times. But I guess for starters, for me, the game that kind of set the tone for the season was the early season Chicago game around Thanksgiving, the overtime win. That was one of my favorite moments because beating Chicago is always the best. It is never not fun. It is always a good time.
Absolutely. And that one, that was Gabrick with the game winner. Probably, I think, to this point, especially since overtimes have sort of managed to you know, coaches can always find a way to make things more boring and more defensive. So I'm not sure if we've had an overtime as good as that Chicago overtime since. Nashville was earlier in the season with Drew Doughty breaking up the 2-on-1 with the shaft of his stick and Jeff Carter immediately scoring at the other end. But since then, I'm not sure we've had as good an overtime finish. And that Chicago game kicked off, I think, a 6-game winning streak. So That was definitely was a tone setter.
Yeah, that was the definitely like the height of the 3-versus-3 overtime right before, either right around or right before when they announced it was going to be the All-Star format. And it was very emblematic of what the season had been like for 3-on-3 hockey to that point. It was just wild back and forth. And, I mean, I haven't had a time in overtime in the regular season where I felt like I was living and dying with each rush up the ice like I have with overtime this season, especially early, and especially in that game against Chicago.
And in fact, three nights later, the very next game against Vancouver, Kopitar wins that one in overtime. They come back a week later with Alec Martinez scoring against Columbus. Someone, we published an article today about the recurring nine numbers feature, and going over some of the reasons the Kings have managed to clinch this early, and we got a response basically saying two words, overtime wins, which is a really fair point after the way last season went.
Definitely. I mean, definitely no extra hockey woes this season. It's been pretty steady, pretty fortunate, probably for sure. I mean, we did point out wins against Vancouver and Columbus, which I guess you'd expect over the long haul the Kings would outperform them at 3-on-3, but mm-hmm. Definitely some good fortune there, which is overdue for a Kings team that has experienced quite a bit of bad fortune as far as on-ice results go in the regular season since 2009-10. Underachieved in the regular season, finally having a season where they have had things go their way, and that's why they are where they are in the playoff race and in the race for the Pacific Division.
Absolutely. And one of the more noticeable differences is we always talk about how much the Kings struggle in January and February, and it was a bit of a slog at some points, especially towards the end of the second half of February where the Kings forgot how to score. But January, I think, was notable because the Kings managed to defeat both Anaheim and San Jose in their own buildings, although obviously Anaheim ain't that far away. And I think Vincent LeCavalier scored in both of those games, and against the Sharks, he scores with 12 seconds left. And LeCavalier, we've talked a lot about him and his ups and downs, but
hey, I think he's wonderful. I just think he's a spectacular hockey player. I love Vinny LeCavalier. I'm not being serious right now.
Oh, we were just going to move on right and leave it right there, and no one would have known the difference. Because you haven't said anything bad about Vinny.
I've never once said a bad thing about Vinny. If you want something fun, though, you could definitely go to my Twitter and go back in my mentions about a week or so to have a guy who decided that I was just insanely jealous of Vinny LeCavalier's extraordinary proficiency in bed. And that's why I was about his play. I believe his exact words were legendary cock. Legendary cock.
Oh, my God.
So Vinny LeCavalier
we've been going for 10 minutes, and here we are. You know,
Vinny LeCavalier has a legendary cock, just so we all are on the same page.
Well, hopefully... no, you know what? I don't even have a response to that. I think we're just going
to... Welcome to JewelsCast, everybody.
This is your flustered host, and you're not so flustered host. And I'm just going to go ahead and talk about that 9-2 win in Boston instead, because that sounds a lot better to me right now.
That was fun. I enjoyed that game.
I had forgotten they took 57 shots in that game. It was the rare combination of shooting at will and scoring at will.
It was great. It was great because I remember early in the last game against Boston, the Kings were up 2-0 early, and it was they had poured on like 20 shots in the first 15 minutes of the game, and I tweeted something like, oh, the Kings have like 500 shots in the last four periods against Boston, and then they had like two shots the rest of the game. It was ridiculous. They'd like completely stopped possessing the puck and let Boston pretty much run them over, which is a score effects thing against a decent team. But it was pretty funny to tweet that, and then immediately the Kings just got run over.
And thankfully, they ran the Kings over, and Jonathan Quick stayed on his feet and stopped 27, and the Kings got out of it with a win. But since then, you know, it's been two losses, one in a game they probably shouldn't have won, and one in a game they definitely should have won. And, of course, here we are talking about the highs of the season, and I immediately bring it back to recent losing, which is, I think, what we do as Kings fans.
Hey, the Kings, if they're going to clinch with, like, 11 games left in the season, I really don't care if they're going to lose to the Minnesota Wild, although I would rather they beat the Minnesota Wild and get the chance to play the Colorado Avalanche in the first round, but I'm not really afraid of the Minnesota Wild. So they can lose whatever they want to lose. Losing to the Predators is probably a good thing, because avoiding the Predators in the first round would be an exceptional thing for the Kings.
Now, if Nashville does manage to surpass Chicago, would you rather play Chicago?
I am 100% for beating Chicago, and I have a lot of reasons for this. One, beating Chicago, as I said, always the best, never not a good time. Two, I think that going head-to-head with Chicago and beating them on the route to the third cup, which would match their total, and also beat them in playoff series head-to-head, would be pretty spectacular to me, and I would love for the Kings to just like have that claim in the LA-Chicago era of having the same amount of cups and the superior team in the playoffs head-to-head. That would be pretty good for me personally. So
and
I
think, I think, you know, we were going to talk about maybe some of the more intimidating opponents here for the Kings going into the playoffs, but at the same time, maybe it's the two cups, maybe it's the fact that they're actually leading division for once and that they've played really well most of the season, but there isn't a team I think that the Kings wouldn't be favored against if they went up against them in the playoffs. Maybe if you're talking about the Ducks from a month ago, but since then the Ducks have leveled off a little bit, the Kings have, you know, surged.
Yeah, I don't think there's a team that the Kings need to really be afraid of. The Predators are very good. I get a very 11-12 LA Kings feel from them that they've underachieved for a lot of the season. Now they've kind of righted the ship, and they're pretty locked into a playoff spot at this point. It'd be shocking if they somehow missed or even fell down to a place where they'd play the Kings, to be honest. So Nashville is a scary team to me. I don't really believe in anybody else in Central. I think Chicago is noticeably worse this year. The Stars, I don't buy into them this year. I know they're good. Their underlying numbers are good, but I think they'll get roasted by their bad goaltending will do them in. Bad goaltending, bad defense will do them in the playoffs. The Blues are the Blues. I just will never believe in the Blues. I think they're kind of what people think the Kings are, and that they struggle to create true offense. They're a good team for sure. I mean, anybody with Tarasenko has instant offense right there. But I don't fear anybody except the Predators a bit and maybe the Ducks. Those are very good teams. I mean, obviously anybody can beat the Kings in a 7-game series because hockey is unfortunate, as we've seen many times. But as far as teams to be afraid of, I mean, I'm not afraid of the Washington Capitals. I'm not afraid of the Pittsburgh Penguins despite their much improved play. I don't think the Kings need to be afraid of anybody. They've got everything going for them. They've got regular season success. They've got postseason success historically. They're the team that everybody's going to not want to play in the playoffs most likely.
Yeah, and I agree. I think the biggest priority is avoiding the Ducks. Well, the biggest priority was avoiding the Ducks in the first round. Now there's, you know, very little chance of that. It would require San Jose passing both Anaheim and Los Angeles. So secondary to that, I think you want to avoid the Central team, one of the better lower tier Central teams. Avoid Nashville and, you know, avoid Chicago if you can. And the way to do that is to get that number one seed because, you know, Devin Dubnyk can steal one game from the Kings. I don't know if he can steal three or four in a series.
Yeah, and I mean, we were a Nick Shore what tapping from tying the game last night, so it's not like we were far away.
Now, someone, I think it was Japers Rink, was commenting on an article that was posted about who the Capitals should fear most in the playoffs, and the response was basically, well, the team the Capitals should be the most afraid of is the Washington Capitals. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say something about the Capitals, but I think it's fair in their point of view to be afraid of themselves more than anything.
Yeah, and that was sort of going to segue into the next topic, which is the defensemen. And it's something we've, you know, been keeping tabs on all year, especially since the Kings picked up Luke Shen and shipped out Christian Ehrhoff and got the piece back in return. And it feels like if anything is going to undermine the Kings in the playoffs this year, aside from maybe, you know, quick lapsing, which hasn't happened in a while, it's going to be having to rely too much on the top four defensemen or relying too much on the not top four defensemen.
It will, if Sutter is willing to go away from Scuderi and is willing to just go with a top four of well, he's probably not going to go away from Shen before he goes away from McNabb. It's hard to say for sure, but I would assume that McNabb is actually lower than Shen on the depth chart. I'm not sure how the pairings add up off the top of my head, but I don't think you're going to see him go away from – I don't think you're going to see him go like the Quenneville route where he just plays his top four and Michael Roosevelt plays like 4 minutes a series or something like that. It's not going to be anything where Stu Bickel or whoever was sitting on the bench or whatever like it was like that. You won't see anything like that. But I do think that Sutter needs to stop relying on Scuderi in that top pairing because Doughty has had a world-class season and seems like it would be just a waste of his skills to drag him down with a ball and chain.
And it's been fascinating to watch how much ice time Scuderi gets. For the record, his season low was 3:30 against Tampa Bay back in January, obviously when he was still with Chicago. But the last few games, since he played over 23 minutes in 4 out of 5 games, ending with the Chicago game and the Dallas game. And since then, he's played 13 minutes, 19 and a half minutes, 18 minutes, and 13 and a half minutes in the last 4 games. So Sutter, I think, is sort of showing his hand here as to how he intends to use Rob Scuderi, and I agree. I don't think Scuderi is going to get stapled to the bench any more than he is now. But it would be interesting to see if he does go with he tried out Scuderi and Shen together yesterday. I don't know if he would move Shen up with Martinez or somebody and rely on Doughty and Muzzin for 30 minutes a game. But I think you have to have Shen in the rotation and McNabb in the rotation if you want to, you know, not run your guys into the ground.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen, I think we've seen that Doughty can carry a pretty heavy workload. I don't think Muzzin's minutes have ever been more than 22, 23 minutes a game at most, probably on average. He's played a few games over that, but he's never done it for more than a few games at a time, probably. So, but it'd be interesting to see, because, I mean, if you're going to do it, the Kings are pretty used to the playoff grind. I mean, they'd probably just settle in and get focused. It's something where they could just get through it if they need to, if Sutter does want to staple on the bench. I don't think he'll do it, but I think they could, and I think they'd be fine. I don't think Scuderi is going to sink the team. I don't see that happening. I mean, it's easy to doomsday about it, and I think he could cost the Kings a game, which, again, could do the Kings in a playoff series, but... And I'd rather not have him on the ice in a critical overtime, because that was actually something I thought back in the Chicago series back in 2014 when Michael Hanzus actually won the game for Chicago. It's like Hanzus is going to be the one that does Chicago in. He actually randomly, unluckily, wound up winning the game for Chicago. You'd rather not see those guys on the ice in a big moment. That's where the difference between a great player and a bad player really comes in. It's not that there's a huge difference on the whole, but in those individual moments, you can victimize a bad player. And that's something I think another writer for Jules, Shang, did a great job highlighting, is that the Capitals and their comeback against the Kings really picked on Scuderi, which most teams should be doing anyway. It should be what you probably pick from the start, is to avoid Doughty and target Scuderi, but Scuderi didn't have an answer for it. And if a team figures that out in game two of a series and never goes away from it, that could be trouble. But I don't think that'll happen, and I think Sutter's pretty good at adjusting on the fly. He's actually been pretty good at it. I think our sect of the internet probably underrates Sutter a little bit. I think he's a pretty good game manager and a pretty good series manager too.
Yeah, I think that goes for a lot of coaches. And I was going to say coaches that don't win titles, but, you know, Sutter's won too. But there is a tendency to focus more on the bad line changes. But if you give Sutter, you know, a few veteran players, he's going to use them. He's not just going to, you know, go away from them. And I think it was against the Rangers where the Kings were losing by two at the beginning of the third period and by one for a large part of the third. And Sutter really just, I think, completely kept Scuderi on the bench for the vast majority of the third period. And he pulled McNabb off the ice quite a bit, too. But if the Kings have a lead in the third period, I think Sutter's still going to use Scuderi. And I think if you can use him in the right situations, then I agree he's not going to sink the team. But you don't want to see Scuderi and Shen get trapped in their own zone too often.
No, and it'll happen, most likely. It'll happen where they will have a couple of bad shifts where they're stuck together. But I think if the Kings are trailing, you're not going to see Scuderi on the ice, and you'd rather not see the Kings behind, and maybe Scuderi being on the ice makes that more likely to happen. But I don't think it's going to be enough to sink a whole playoff series. Scuderi isn't going to be the difference. He'll be the difference in a goal, maybe. He'll be the difference in a couple of plays where Jonathan Quick has to come up with a big save, maybe, and he'll be the difference in a long shift once in a while, maybe. And this is a lot of piling onto Scuderi. I don't like that he's in the lineup, but I don't think he's going to kill the team.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think. I mean, the Kings won an entire playoff series with Jeff Schultz, who, in fairness, played reasonably well in those seven games against Anaheim, but it's, you know, the Kings, the top end is just, it's good enough to survive.
I mean, we don't have a Jack Johnson in the lineup. That's good.
That's true. We won, four playoff games with Jack Johnson in the lineup in past years. So over 2 years, but it's something.
We've won a lot more playoff games with Rob Scuderi than we have with Jack Johnson.
It's true. So we did touch on Shen, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about Shen and also about Milan Lucic, because I think Shen has probably exceeded expectations. I remember the Fox Sports West graphic basically saying that there were absolutely no expectations for Shen in the least complimentary way possible, but I think he's played well enough to earn a spot, and I think Lucic in particular has... you know, aside from the occasional frustrating retaliation penalty, I think his really earned his keep. But the question is whether they are going to fit into the lineup next year and beyond. Do you think they both get re-signed?
I think there's a pretty good chance that they both get re-signed. For one, Dean Lombardi really likes to re-sign people. He doesn't like to let people go. I mean, he even re-signed Dustin Penner for his one good playoff series and brought him back for another year. And Dustin Penner was never any good in the regular season. He was perhaps unlucky, but he was not a productive player for the Kings in the regular season at any point, and he kept coming back to the Kings because Lombardi just doesn't like to let these guys go. Obviously, Mike Richards is another example that doesn't like to let those guys go. Won't get into how that finished right now, but I do think Milan Lucic has been a very good player this year. I've gone back and looked at my preseason projection. I think he's either already surpassed or is right on the cusp of surpassing what I projected, which I think was around 45 points. He's been a very useful player. He's been strong. He's had a couple of bad penalties, and he doesn't look like he's the best out there. He's a very basic and straightforward player, but he's very efficient and kind of in the Justin Williams way with a little less skill. He's not going to push possession as much as Williams ever did, but he's very straightforward, makes the right play most of the time, makes the simple play most of the time, and he does it very well, and that's why he's carved out a role in this league. It's not as much of his fighting or his hitting, which, frankly, he hasn't done a lot of this year. He's had a couple of really bad meltdowns, which are embarrassing, and I wish he would not do them. But he's been just a nice, straightforward, basic player this year. He's been very good. I don't think he's worth $6 million, but he's been very good. And if he's back on the team next year, he's definitely not going to hurt them on the ice. I mean, in the salary cap, he could hurt them. As far as Shen goes, it wouldn't be the worst to bring him back. I don't think there's much purpose to it. I wouldn't hate it because it's never a bad idea to have extra depth. And you can probably trade Luke Shen next season if he has a decent season and you want to bring up Gravel and Forbort. But I don't think it's a big deal. He won't be expensive.
Yeah, and it seems like it's got to be really tied to Matt Green at this point. Because I'm having my doubts that we're ever going to see Matt Green back in the lineup. Green is re-signed he's under contract through 2018. But, you know, I think Green is going to be a coach for this team at some point. He's, you know, everybody says he's the next, you know, sort of great assistant coach in waiting. And I hope he comes back, but if he doesn't, that's really Shen's spot to lose. And with both Shen and Lucic, you forget how, quote-unquote, young they are. Shen's only 26. Lucic is only 27, which I would not have known without looking it up.
Milan Lucic feels like he's been in the league for, like, 15 years. If you told me he was 41 years old, I would have been like, yep, that's right on the point. That's it right there. He's about to retire.
Yeah, he's got a couple of Jager years left in him. But if I think – I mean – that the point is they can't sign Lucic until he's 40. They literally cannot do it. So if they do sign him, is he going to be useful for, you know, six more years? I would bet on him being useful for at least the first four, and then let's see what happens.
The Gabrick argument that I used at the time to say that the Gabrick contract was worthwhile was the Kings probably aren't going to be super competitive 4 years down the line, so there's not really a lot of problem. And especially with how rapidly they have gotten rid of draft picks like their fleas. They've got rid of them as quickly as they could. They've shed them like that they were a virus that needed an antidote. They don't have any left. They don't have a lot of a future right now beyond what this core can bring to the table. And this core is very good, and it's still pretty young. It's going to be effective for probably – it's going to be a legit contender for at least three or four more years, I would guess.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you buy out Lucic's remaining real good years, you're going to get a good player at least in that stretch of time, and that's not the worst thing in the world. It's actually – the Kings probably lucked out in being able to replace Williams with Lucic that quickly and that easily.
Yeah. And first of all, the Kings have three draft picks in 2016, and one of them was a conditional seventh rounder that they They kept because LA did not sign James Livingston in the 2014 offseason. So other than that, we've got a second and a fourth. As for Lucic, one interesting thing that I saw in the 30 Thoughts column today, LA Freeman, is with the expansion draft coming up, there is a rule that you have to expose at least 25% of your salary. So it keeps teams from sort of just taking all of these dirt cheap players and exposing them and keeping all of their expensive players. And obviously I think Brown gets exposed if there's an expansion draft and he's at 5.875 million a year. But you do need to expose a little bit of actual salary after that. And for someone like Shen or for someone like, I don't think they would expose Lucic unless they absolutely had to, but there's sort of an upside of having a little bit of that retained salary there.
Yeah. And I mean, the Kings, as far as salary goes, they'll be able to expose, Brown. They'll be able to expose, Gabrick if they want to, and they'll probably not get punished for that. Gabbert could be somebody that a team takes. Brown could be too. I would be stunned if Brown isn't drafted, actually, just because he's a good face of a franchise, to be honest. He's a good community guy, good to build around, to build at least a good locker room around, I think, which is probably more important than we give credit to.
Right. And most likely, teams won't be able to take more than one player from any given team. So you don't lose Brown and Gabbert.
Yeah, you're only going to lose one of those. So, I mean, you can expose both, and you're going to be fine. And that covers it without really hurting the team. You're not going to have to expose Kopitar or anything like that. Like, there's no real – I actually really like the way it sounds like the expansion draft is going to be set up if it happens, and it sounds like it probably will.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I'd have to go back and check the poll. So bear with me for a second. But very few people, you know – a lot of people really like Brown. I'm sure there are still a ton of Brown jerseys at Staples these days, but there wasn't a whole lot of argument against exposing Brown. And just with the way that the cap situation is sort of boiling down, I really don't think there's any option other than leaving him open.
Pretty much. And I love Dustin Brown. I think very highly of Dustin Brown. I think he's still a very good hockey player, but he also has probably got to go. He can't. That contract will hurt the Kings if they want to compete beyond the next 3 years.
Yeah, and Brown is sitting on I think 27 points on the season, and he has again been unlucky. And I think looking at him day to day, it doesn't seem like he's lost a whole lot of effectiveness, but it's not happening.
Yeah, and it's at the point now where if it happens long enough, you have to start believing there's something to it. He's not the offensive player he was, which isn't surprising. He's older than he was at 26, which is your scoring prime. He's definitely on the backside of his career, and he's got a very long contract still. So exposing him is a good idea. And hopefully, I mean, if he doesn't get drafted, I wouldn't be upset. But if he does, it's not bad to lose that contract at all.
Yeah, and I think if the Kings do lose anybody other than Dustin Brown, it's either going to be, like, you know, a Kyle Clifford who would, you know, probably play right away on the expansion team's third line, maybe their fourth line if they really get some talent, or if the Kings are forced to leave, you know, if they can only protect three defensemen, then maybe someone like McNabb gets picked up. But I agree with you. I think Brown makes sense for both sides.
I think Martinez is another option there too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, Martinez obviously is worth more, and he's being paid more. I mean, we haven't talked a whole lot about Alec Martinez this season, because of the way Dowdy has played and because of the arrivals of Shen and Scuderi. But it's hard to get sort of a read on how Martinez has done this year.
I think the Kings have been very happy with him, and that's something that I've gathered from reading John Rosen's tweets, especially to Andrew, where they've talked about it, where the Kings have been very happy with Martinez's play. I haven't been as thrilled with it at times. I think he's been actually exceptional since the Scuderi trade. He's been very good of late, And he's been much better, more relaxed and comfortable defensively. And I do think there is something to the theory that having somebody else up on the top pairing does smooth things out. I like Muzzin being able to anchor another pairing because him and Doughty are both capable of it. They both can push a pairing to success. And it's better if you move everybody's role down just a notch. Like McNabb, I think, has looked better lately. I think Martinez has looked better. It's been at the expense of Doughty, though, and the question is whether that's worth it or not.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I've been happy with Martinez, honestly, most of the season. I know his possession numbers have, you know, are almost entirely dependent on who he plays with, which I think is, you know, for a guy who's your fourth best defenseman or whatever is fine. But he hasn't really shown he can anchor a pairing. The thing that I think everyone has noticed the most is the shot blocking, which he is legitimately good at. It's not just a case of being trapped in his own zone all the time. But it's been interesting because he started out his career, you know, in sort of the Muzzin role, getting very sheltered minutes and absolutely killing them. And, you know, whereas Muzzin has sort of shown an ability to thrive no matter what he's doing, Martinez maybe gets stuck in his own zone a lot more, but he's getting the hardest minutes on the team. He's getting the most defensive starts, and he's not giving up many goals this season. And whether that's luck-based or not, he's been about as the results have been about as good as you could hope for in terms of a straight allowing goals versus blocking shots and clearing pucks standpoint. But he's 28 years old. He's probably about as good as he's going to get. So you hope that he shows some ability with a subpar partner in the future.
Yeah, and it's definitely been a case where I think there was a stretch of time in the middle of the season, especially when his play lagged, and he was probably directly responsible for a few goals or at least a few very high-profile chances. But it was a lot like the case with Muzzin, and like you mentioned, it was kind of another case where he looks worse than he actually is because his bad plays were so noticeable for such a stretch of time, and it made the rest of his play seem poor. But he probably, like, I think I even commented that I thought he seemed poor lately, but he probably never really lagged. There was just a time when the spotlight had suddenly shone on him, and it was not being very kind, but he's been much better lately. He's been very responsible. He's been very good. I have no problems with Alec Martinez at all this season in general. I think he had a weak stretch of time. It's been pretty good lately.
Yeah, and I can't think of too many mistakes he's really made as of late. And one thing Martinez has done more this year is he's taken more penalties. The last couple seasons, I'm looking at the stats, he had 10 penalty minutes in 56 games last year. And this year he's up to 40, which seems about normal for a defenseman who's, you know, being tested a lot. But he's also, you know, he's playing power play and penalty kill. He's done really well in the power play. Not as well as Drew Doughty, but Martinez does have 12 points in the power play. So I think overall you could do a lot worse with the guy that you're asking to sort of anchor the second pair.
That's definitely true. And this actually seems like a pretty good segue into the Norris talk here.
Yeah.
Drew Doughty, since you mentioned his power play time, he's been outstanding on the power play this year. He's been probably the best player on the Kings on the power play, which is a far cry from what he used to be, because I was never thrilled to see him on the power play before. He was not very dynamic. When he got the puck at the point, he'd always take his long windup and he'd hesitate and he'd like half fake a shot and he'd shoot it right into the defender's legs, and he was never very productive on it. He didn't create lanes very well, but this season's been vastly different. He has a bunch of primary points. He has 9 power play goals this year, and I think maybe 8 more primary assists. I might have those reversed. I'm not sure. So he's been awesome this year. He's been great. That's just on the power play. And he's actually, since we're right there, he's been more productive on the power play than Erik Karlsson has. They produced about the same amount of points. Drew Doughty has produced more primary points on the power play, and Erik Karlsson has received significantly more time on the power play than Drew Doughty has. So Doughty, I think his points per 60 on the power play is around 6.5, whereas Karlsson's is around 3 point something. It's 3.5, 3.8, something like that.
Yeah.
Drew Doughty has been outstanding this year, and I think there's this weird regression, or I won't call it regression because that's not the right word, but there's this weird reversion in hockey Twitter and hockey analytics lately where suddenly points are everything again. And I mean, Erik Karlsson is outstanding. He is absolutely one of the top three defensemen in the league. He might be the very best defenseman in the league. He probably is. He's definitely the best offensive defenseman in the league. I don't think anybody doubts that. But he has allowed a lot of goals this year. If you look at Craig Anderson's numbers with and without him, it's the Craig Anderson's goals against per 60 with him on the ice is like 3.1, and without him on the ice it's like 1.8. It's a huge difference, and a lot of that is bad luck because this has never been something that has plagued Erik Karlsson before in his career. But we don't know, in the analytics community especially, we don't know and we don't watch enough to know how exactly good defensively somebody is, and we don't know how to really quantify contributions. We can say, well, the Senators give up way more shots without Karlsson on the ice than they do with him on the ice. Well, of course they do. He's the best player on that team. The Senators aren't very good. I don't think it's right to punish Doughty for Karlsson's teammates being bad. I don't think it's right to punish Doughty for his teammates being good. It's real tough to pinpoint exactly how much somebody contributes defensively. And Karlsson, bad luck or not, has been... I mean, he's given up a lot of goals. He's given up the most high-danger scoring chances per 60 among defenders on either team. He has probably had a rough year defensively. And whether that's made his offense better, it's tough to say. I don't watch enough Senators games, to be honest. I'll be straight-up honest about that. But he does allow, statistically, a lot of scoring chances. He does allow a lot of goals. And the Norris isn't about predicting who the best defenseman will be next year, when this will probably be something that evens out either through luck or through some slight change in whatever Karlsson does, or confidence, or whatever goes into variance. It'll change for Karlsson next year, and he probably won't allow as many goals, but he has this season, and that's something that's worth considering.
Yeah, and I think that point is well taken about, you know, punishing Doughty for, you know, who he's playing with or who else is on his team, because Karlsson doesn't have a Muzzin, and that obviously is going to be better for Doughty in the long run, because Muzzin can take some of that weight off. But at the same time, if you put Muzzin and Doughty on two separate pairings, then all of a sudden Doughty's possession numbers, his relative possession numbers, aren't going to look so good. So it's a very tricky balance to strike, and I think the all-or-nothing nature it's sort of taken on both sides, where you have Drew Doughty as the best player in the world on one side, and Erik Karlsson is Bobby Orr, and Drew Doughty is not one of the top 10 defensemen in the league. On the other side, it's, you know, you sort of tune it out.
I will say that I see a lot of mutual respect for both players, what both players bring to the table. I don't think I see anybody saying... I mean, I see some people... I mean, there's always outliers. There's some people that don't think Karlsson overall is a top five defender, which I think is ludicrous. I mean, I think if you produce as much as he does, you would have to be so bad defensively that you can't play. But... I mean, we're still at the point in hockey analytics where we don't know a lot defensively, and it reminds me a lot of where baseball was 10 years ago. I mean, there was a time when we thought Adam Dunn, because he could hit home runs and he could get on base, that he was a really valuable player, and it didn't matter what his defense was. If you take nine Adam Dunns, you're going to win over nine David Ecksteins, and they actually turned out to be about the same player, because Adam Dunn was so bad defensively. And not that David Ekstein was good, but he was just a thoroughly average player. They were both average players. And Erik Karlsson is not an average player, but we don't know how much Drew Doughty's defensive contributions help him, and how much Erik Karlsson's, I won't say hurt him, because I don't know if his defense hurts him, but how much Doughty is better, or maybe they're not better. Maybe Karlsson is just a world-class defenseman that's just been completely beaten by bad luck this year. It's definitely possible. There's nothing in previous numbers to suggest that he should be getting significantly worse save percentage than his teammates, but he has this year, and
yeah,
that's something to contend with.
And as always, the point is it's more complicated than it seems.
It definitely is. It's a nuanced discussion, and I don't see a lot of nuance. It's just, well, have you seen the latest graph that shows how many points Erik Karlsson has, which I don't care about. I know Erik Karlsson scores a lot of points. I know, like, you can put – I know if you put a graph out there that says points by defenseman that if I look at the upper right-hand corner, Erik Karlsson's going to be leagues ahead of everybody else. I get it. He's really good offensively. He's spectacular offensively. He's a generational talent offensively. But it isn't his total contribution. It isn't Doughty's total contribution. And I see people play the what-if game with Erik Karlsson a lot where, well, what if he had better teammates? If he had a better power play, he'd be like a 100-point player. But if we play that same game with Doughty, we'll say, well, he's never been able to do it so far. Well, we haven't seen what Karlsson would do on the Kings. We haven't seen what Doughty would do on the Senators. We don't know, because those are players you build your game plan around. So Karlsson's talents go to L.A., they play a significantly different game. If Doughty goes to Senators, they play a significantly different game. They have a different game, and I don't know which one is more valuable. They both have a lot of value. The one thing I'll say about Doughty against him is that this is the year of Patrick Kane, and I think an incredibly more reasonable discussion, or at least a more interesting discussion to me than Doughty doesn't score enough points would be, should we be rewarding a man that was accused of violence against a woman? I'm not going to say that I think he did it, back in 2012. I don't know, but it's a year where the optics on how the NHL has treated women have been incredibly bad. And it's not just the optics. The NHL has straight up treated women bad. If you're going to have a year where Patrick Kane wins the Hart and Drew Doughty wins the Norris, that's a tough look for people that pay attention to the NHL and know Drew Doughty's history. That doesn't mean I think Drew Doughty's a bad guy. The thing is, I don't know, and none of us do know. None of us know.
Yeah.
And it's tough every time to make this discussion, to make this argument for Drew Doughty, knowing that he might have done something bad.
Right. And and as you said, of all years, it has been interesting that that's been glossed over so much. The discussion needs nuance. Hopefully we can add some nuance in the coming days. We'll have more about Doughty and Karlsson in the coming days on the blog. We got 2 minutes left, so let's just talk really quick about Anze Kopitar, because that just seems an appropriate way to end the episode.
Mandatory.
Selke this year. Mandatory. I did instruct that as mandatory.
Selke, I mean, no, I don't think he wins it this year. I don't think it's been his best year defensively. I don't think he deserves it this year. I think Patrice Bergeron pretty much deserves it every year. I hope he wins it. I think the one thing we lose in sight of as far as awards go is it's totally cool to like reward guys for lifetime achievement. Like, it's fine. It's fine to know more than one worthwhile player in an era. Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's good to have more people rewarded for what they do. And I'd be very in favor of giving an award to, a player in each conference. I think it's good to highlight more players because it's something NBC and the NHL have been extraordinarily bad at. So I'm very for Anze Kopitar deservedly or undeservedly winning a Selke trophy this year. Patrice Bergeron is excellent. He probably deserves it. I hope Anze Kopitar wins.
Yeah, and NBCSN really showed some tunnel vision the other night when the Kings, I think they spent the entire night talking about Drew Doughty, and he had, Doughty had one of his best games of the season that evening. But very little mention of Anze Kopitar, what he's done, what he continues to do. He's at 67 points. He's got an outside shot at setting a career high in goals. I think he deserves every award in the world. If he wins the Selke this year, it will be a very, it'll be deserved. And I think if the Kings win the division, I do think he'll win it as a way of sort of rewarding the team's success. So we're at 30 seconds. I just want to thank everybody for tuning in, sticking with us through the 10 minutes of silence. We'll be back again soon, hopefully before the playoffs start. Hopefully by then we'll know who we're playing. Nick, any last words?
Hopefully next time we know what we're doing.
I promise we will know what we are doing next time. So thanks
wait,
everybody
more,
for listening.
I have more last words.
Go.
I have
five seconds.
Vinny LeCavalier, legendary cock. Good night.
Bye.